Right, thank you all for coming along to one of our informal talks. We have North London branch on Beginner's Guide to Economic Crises. As I warned the branch at our previous business meeting, I'm not really intending this to be a sort of traditional lecture followed by Q&A format. It could turn into that if need be, but it's probably more along the lines of sort of seminar style format. So there'll be sort of phases of discussion, which will probably keep coming back to me, and I'll try and move it along sort of like a rough plan of what I'd like to say and get across this evening. What I threatened, and hopefully some people have had a bit of a think about, was I was going to start off by actually just throwing the floor open to the question of if anyone has any experiences of the economic crisis or any observations they'd like to make of what they've heard, or things aren't there. So I'll just give you a quick couple of examples for myself. For the record, that wasn't someone being murdered. That was a chair. I work for a university, I've got an occupational pension scheme through the university, which they are currently in the process of reducing our terms and conditions on because the pension fund is technically insolvent, according to accountancy rules. And the reason for this, obviously, is by and large, I mean, they're trying to blame it on life expectancy and whatnot, but a large part is due to the fall of income from shares and investment. And this is a knock-on effect that's coming down to me personally. It's not the end of the world. I mean, they're still going to maintain some terms and conditions because they have to keep attracting staff. But certainly, it's what I think of as one example of the way in which the crisis has impinged upon me personally. I'm just wondering if anyone else here has got similar observations about themselves or things they've heard about happened to other people.
I got made redundant two or three years ago as the direct result because the bank would have given an overdraft facility to the charity I was working for, which normally did when there's a cash flow problem. But in the light of 2007, 2008, they couldn't go past a certain limit, even though the cash forecast was going to show black 4 or 5 months later. They said, we can't dip it on 2 or 3 months, we just can't. And the organisation shut down.
I work for a local authority, Stevenage, and was made redundant, along with I can't remember how many other people. The response was that they fired, well, they didn't fire, they made redundant a lot of their HR staff, human resources staff, who had personal relationships with members of staff, and they got in a lot of X-Men and replaced them so that they could do massive redundancies without any kind of sense of conscience or anything like that. I actually got this right from the top. This was the reason it actually happened. One of the things that most distressed me, though, about it was that when I first started working there 15 years ago, most of the staff were very clearly had a sort of public ethos kind of motivation. They wanted to provide a service, and they were very keen. They would sort of go out of their way to try and help people. You know, I worked in the housing department, and they were very, very good at that. And with the crisis and with the austerity politics, the changing sort of government legislation, which we of course were as a local authority were required to enact, what was amazing to me was the way in which attitudes changed of these people who had this kind of very strong public service ethos. Within maybe a year, people who in the past were kind of trying to help people were saying, oh, they can't expect that. What do they expect us to do? We haven't got all this money. They're just expecting too much. And it turned around. And it was really extraordinary to me just how quickly people's attitudes were turned around within the culture. Because it was like, this was the new culture. These were the new training courses. These were the new attitudes that were being provided to people. And they just lapped them up. And I found that quite extraordinary. So it doesn't take much.
Anyone else?
Well, I was made redundant 5 years ago. I worked for a project in an IT firm, and the project I was working for was a retailer. Well known retailer. And they had to cut, well, they drop an income user thing, and they had to cut down on their support staff, and because that was the last one in, I sort of got the chop. All the projects were, all the clients in the firm were all sort of cutting back, simply, you know, all reducing. So a lot of redundancies at that time. I think IT took a hit as well as everything else.
I think these are fairly, I wouldn't say typical, but they're quite common stories. And I think that a lot of people would associate with what's happened over the last 7 or 8 years. I think we could throw in pay rises have been either not given or held down, so less than inflation, and all sorts of budgets have been cut. So, and we've got private sector, charity sector, and the public sector represented there, and universities, which are a bit of something else. So that's a reasonable range, and to give a clear example of, you know, the scope that the crisis has reached out and hit everyone, I think, in some way, and that's kind of the point of when you understand economic crisis. It does. We literally are all in it together because it literally affects everyone. So what I'm going to do, hopefully, what some of the things I'll say might sound like I'm being incredibly simplistic, but I did say that I was going to try and do a sort of like jargon-free version of events, and also going back to re-examining basic notions is a good way of beginning scientific, or we can call it an approach to understanding something. So if any of you are professors of neo-endogenous growth theorem or anything like that, you know, I apologise in advance, I will quite gladly vacate the chair to someone with greater knowledge. So I think the first point I was going to get across is what a crisis is, because that's something that's very often taken for granted. And I think a good working definition of a crisis is when the behaviour of a particular group of people or a society by which they maintain and reproduce themselves no longer is possible. I think that's a fairly succinct.
That's a good one. Did you think of that yourself, Bill?
Oh, that's me. Yes, trying to come with a form of words that doesn't involve lots of Latin. I think there was some Latin in there. But anyway, behaviour. But I think because what I want to do is I want to clearly establish that there is something very specific about the type of crisis we're experiencing. So, for example, a hunter-gatherer society, if the animals that they hunt are no longer there to hunt, they experience a crisis. If an agricultural society has a bad harvest, that's the way in which they experience a crisis. And, of course, both societies can experience the crisis caused by pestilence and by war, so the old four horsemen of the apocalypse. Those can cause crises. But we live in a commercial society, and so for us a crisis is when commerce is no longer possible. That is, when things can no longer be bought or sold, particularly sold. And I think that's the key starting point. In fact, we could end there. That's it. The crisis, the beginner's guide to crisis, if you want to understand it, things aren't sold. Does everyone think that that's a reasonable first premise of where we should come from for crisis?
Things aren't sold. Supply creates its own demand. That's a sort of a classical notion from Say you've got there.
Yes. Well, I was trying not to mention Say's law, but obviously the whole point is...
Sorry, have I balls everything up again?
Well, it's not supply creates its own demand, which of course it does. I mean, you know, you can see things wanted, but the point is that some people might not buy it. They might choose not to buy it today. So Say's law, which is every seller brings a buyer to the market. Yes, but not yet, said Marx. So that's if you want for Marxism, that's the whole.
Not just Marx. I mean, the rest of the classical political economists as well. Well, not a lot of them anyway.
I'll have to go with that. Yes, obviously, and certainly Keynes as well. Keynes also has a lot to say against Say's law. So it's That's it. But that's about as useful as saying that people are dead when they stop breathing. I think it's enough to say that, but obviously you want to say what stopped them from breathing. That's taking it to the next step. So I said that we are in a commercial society, and the basis of commerce is exchange. Is people swapping one commodity or one good, sorry, for another. We call goods that are swapped commodities. And obviously, the simplest example would be if I had a bowl of berries and I went to Jonathan and said, can I have a haunch of your venison? Here's some berries. And we swapped. And that is the basic commercial society. And of course, there's a lot of questions about whether or not any society of pure barter has ever existed.
David Graeber.
But it's certainly at a theoretical level, that, you know, as a way of thinking about us like that is the most basic how we all understand to swap one thing for another. And of course, in a more extended way, so I got Jonathan to get the haunch of venison off him. But what I really want is to get the wicker basket of Oliver. But Oliver wants the venison, so I give him berries, get the venison, and give the venison to Oliver, who then gives me the wicker basket. And you might notice I've kind of chosen my examples here very carefully, because these are all examples of things that can be created by going directly to nature. There's no capital involved. That comes later. But of course, the problem comes if Oliver decides that he no longer wants to have a haunch of venison. And that's it. There's nothing I can do. If he just decides randomly not to have it, I'm stuck with a haunch of venison I don't want. And of course, I'm then going to stop giving berries to Jonathan, because I'm no longer going to try and get venison off him to get wicker baskets off Oliver. And that's an economic question. That shows how it spreads very quickly from various people engaging in economic activity independently, and it's just that simple decision to not buy can cause that sort of disruption across our entirely imaginary simple market relationship that we've got, barter market relationship we've got here. And that's kind of the slightly more embryonic. I mean, that's kind of like more like saying that, you know, when blood stops going around the body, that's what causes death. Because, you know, the blood is no longer carrying the essential nutrients and necessary minerals to the various parts of the body that need them and other chemicals. So it's a slightly more extended version. And then the point is, obviously, in previous societies, the commodity relation was not general. This only becomes a real problem when the commodity relation is incredibly generalised, and everything you can only obtain anything by buying it. So when the whole, all economic activity, all social activity goes through a market, then it becomes a problem that if someone stops buying, then the entire society will fall apart because this chain of disruption spreads out. I just wanted to give a slightly more extended example of this. So instead of being a berry maker, I'm now a small wheat farmer. And what I do is I grow some wheat and I sell it on to a miller, who turns it into flour, who sells it to a baker, who turns it into bread, who sells it to a sandwich maker, who sells it on to a canteen. And if you want, you can imagine that in between all of those, we can insert a wholesaler and a retailer. So between me and the miller, there's a wholesaler and a retailer. Between the miller, there's a horse, and so on and so on. So there's now no longer just me talking directly to my end producer. I will never see the end user of my goods. I'm just producing blind, and all I can do is rely on my wholesaler coming back to me and saying, can I have some more wheat? And it's not until all of these people, there's many more people involved in this chain, many more people who will be affected if the canteen stops selling sandwiches. And of course, we're all producing now blind. We're producing just for as much as we can sell, the market will bear, and it's only when the information comes back to us from our various supply chain members that the canteen market has collapsed, that we are able to turn around and say, well, okay, we need to stop producing. So some of you will be aware of this as, in the phrase, the anarchy of production. So this, and we don't mean anarchy, well, we do mean anarchy. What basically means that all the people involved in the story are acting independently. There's no lateral communication, and there's no communication beyond the very, you know, beyond the person on either side of me in the supply chain.
There's no planning.
There's no planning. Obviously, there are some risks and some ideas that have come out of this anarchy production idea that might need to be knocked on the head a bit later on. But that's the point. But the other key point is that each of them will produce to fill that market, and irrespective of the available resources. So if I keep on going until I'm producing as much wheat as I can, and they turn around and say, well, we want more. I go, well, that's it, I can't give you any more. What I'll do is I'll just put my price up. And then they suddenly start going, okay, he's put his price up, this is starting to affect us. But they will keep on selling. With irrespective, they don't know when that barrier of my natural resources is going to be hit. When I might turn around and say, well, that's it, that's your lot. So we've got two ends, or two possible, now an additional possible cause of the crisis. Not only do we have the simple whim of the canteen owners, who will no longer sell our sandwiches, but we also have the natural resources, the natural limits of the available goods that are feeding into the market. And I suppose we can throw in, moving on swiftly to my next sort of like level of this model, which is that maybe the canteen is a works canteen and it supplies the local steelworks. And what's happened is that they've closed the local steelworks. This local steelworks, which used to have thousands of people working there, has gone. And that is why suddenly my sandwiches are no longer needed. So it's nothing to do with anyone planning rationally in the market or not seeing it coming. It's simply that a big player, someone who was involved in a lot of economic activity, has suddenly pulled out of the market. And this will turn it very quickly into a generalised knock-on supply chain collapse of all sorts of other economic actors, no matter how well they've behaved, no matter how much they've planned. I think, as Dave's example, you know, his charity were fluid and active, except that they were a bit cash-strapped at that particular time. It was just that week the hammer fell. Mm. If it had fell another week, they'd have been fine. Mm. Almost entirely arbitrary and random and bad doodah luck that they went to the bank at that particular moment. And as you say, hitherto they've been able to rely on. So suddenly they've been hit in two different directions. One is their money's out, and the other one is that the bank have suddenly said, well, no, we're not going to treat you the way we always have.
Exactly
the
same personnel as well. They said, we can't do it, we're not allowed anymore, there's limits.
Yeah, so we've got this additional layer, which is everyone all right with this so far? Any questions on this, or observations or thoughts?
Then you meant overproduction. Overproduction of some commodities, both commodities for consumption of individuals and other companies.
Yes. Well, that was the point I was about to move on to, which is that we don't just live in a commercial society. We live in a capitalist society, which is a species of commercial society. And that this adds another layer. So this, what I've been describing, is what any market-based society is prone to. And whether or not, as I say, although we can make theoretical models of market societies of petty producers and, you know, owner-occupiers, and, you know, everyone has their own little workshop and, you know, produces chairs. It's always bloody chairs when it's not tables.
Useful things, chairs.
Well, they're very useful things. They also happen to be things that you can make on your own, which is why Speaker's Corner, someone always asks me, say I make a chair. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, why don't you ask me to say I make a Rolls Royce?
Does the chair exist in philosophers?
Oh, philosophers go for tables because they've got one in front of them when they're
writing. Tables and chairs, yeah.
So we live in a capitalist society. And as Shaymak said, this produces a new class of goods, which I mentioned that I was leaving out. So my original story was, you know, berries, haunches of venison and wicker baskets, all things that you can make directly with nature. You don't need to have machinery or capital or producer goods, yes.
I meant two kinds of production. One for production for individuals and their families to use. One for other businesses.
Yes, that's...
You know? They want half products, half-made products. They want raw materials, etc.
Absolutely. That's what
but in developed countries that the worker roughly gets, manual worker, roughly gets, like Britain, roughly gets what he should get. Therefore, this part is very big. The part that is related to workers that consume. Mostly, workers are mostly manual workers. And this is very big, but in developing countries, it is very small. The main share is for other capitalists to use as their in their products. The product of these capitalists they use in their product as half-made products or raw materials, etc.
Yes, so what Shaywak's talking about is intermediate goods and producer goods that will be made are consumed almost exclusively to make other things, so they never see the final consumer. And this is an important point. So that's the thing that we have in capitalist society. And it's slightly different from the point I was going to make about them. But that is a very good point, that this class of goods does exist, and the capitalists do have to produce for that market as well. And that's where a lot of them make their profits from. And I will hopefully come back to that. But the key point I wanted to make about capitalist society, what it involves is something slightly more extended even than the simple commodity, the simple exchange relationship I've been describing hitherto. So hitherto, when the market's collapsed, all that's happened is that the berry farmer is left with berries in his hand or with some haunches of venison that are left over that he can't sell. I mean, he's just got leftover goods. But what capitalism does, specifically, is it invests, usually money, we'll have to come onto money, I'm afraid, now, but it invests money into future production. So that instead of just having some berries that you can't sell, you've also got the additional invested capital behind them, the column of debt and of money, that you need to recuperate. They need to get their capital back. So essentially, capitalists they spend money in order to create goods that go out in the market so that they get more money back, and they have to complete that cycle. They have to turn it back into money. So if they don't, you've got two different things going on. One is you've got the unsellable goods, and you've also got the capital investment that needs to be fulfilled. And this brings on further problems in the chain. So this is something that's driving us now towards an understanding of what can cause widespread and systematic crises. I think the other thing to understand about the specifics of capitalism is that money is a special commodity, and normally you think it doesn't have a use value. It doesn't have anything that you can do with it except exchange it around and use it to buy other goods, and it's just a commodity like any other. It's just that it happens to be the one that everyone uses as the frame of reference. But what capitalism does is it gives it another specific use value, which is it turns it into an income. So if I have £100 million, then in a society that has a rate of, if the rate of profit is, you know, the general rate amount of money you make back of investing money is 10%, then my £100 million represents £10 million of income. That's how I view it and how I treat it, and that's how I behave towards it. And I need to try and realise that £10 million worth of income somehow. And what I need to do is, sorry, was that hand in the air?
No,
that was scratching.
Scratching.
Damn it.
Roll
a
rat.
I wanted a hand in the air. Like you just don't care. So if you have £10 million, you need to invest it and you need to put it into various enterprises as you can. And you need to chase that 10% profit. But of course, the problem is that everyone else is chasing that 10% profit. And I think the nearest example, the one I'm going to actually slightly extend it out and tell a story. I'm a, as many of you know, I'm a rugby league fan, and I follow for my pains a club called the London Broncos. And last year, the bottom fell out of their ability. They only won one match the entire season. They were absolutely dire. I mean, it was just terrible watching them. And one night, I looked in the bookies to see how much a bet on the other team to win would be. And it was 1 to 500. Yeah, 1 to 500 on to bet, I think it was on Wigan that night or something like that. So, which I did some sums, and I worked out that if I put my entire life savings on that match, I'd get better returns than on my bank's interest. But not by much, only by about a fiver.
As if the Broncos lost.
As if the if I bet against them, and admittedly, I didn't dare put my life savings on that match because on the remote off chance that they might win one.
Oh, yeah.
But the point is, I mean, for instance, I mean that one thing that showed to me. Partly is actually what, you know, because capitalists always talk about risk and that they're managing risks and that they're taking risks. But of course, for the returns they're getting, the risks actually must be quite low in this 1 to 500 sort of area. You know, if you put 500 on, you'll get £1 back. That's just for the tip, so it understands what that means. That's the sort of low. So nice, dependable. You put your money on, because the one thing they don't want to do when they take the risk is lose their shirt, lose all that capital. You know, they want to make their £10 of income, their 10%, if they can. But of course, if you obviously most of you will understand the gambling analogy. If everyone starts betting on the same race, the odds start falling because the bookies aren't stupid. And if everyone starts ploughing into the same source, well, that's a surefire hit. We'll go on that. At that point, the profits will start falling down and returns. So what that will necessarily do is that means in order to get your £10 worth of, or your 10% profit, you're going to have to start going out and looking for riskier and riskier prospects. And eventually, or if you don't, what they'll find is that their profits will start eventually to fall. And they won't achieve that £10, that 10% that they think is their due, so they'll maybe not invest for a little while. So I think what I'm trying to suggest here is that there is a definite motive for some sort of widespread decision for people to just stop investing. Yes.
Not to anticipate you, Bill. Actually, yes, to anticipate you, Bill. Looking for everyone going for their 10% and then the move towards a riskier business is obviously something that has actually happened, particularly over the last 30, 40 years. Particularly, well, I mean, you can say it starts in the 70s and comes to its crescendo in quite recently. And we all know, don't we, about the subprime derivatives and using risk projects that they don't even understand themselves. Apparently, nobody does. Well, at a certain level, nobody actually understands how they work. So, yeah, we know that happened, and that was approximate cause of the crisis, shall we say. The fact of, in the sense that capital was moving into en masse into these very, very risky projects, which then collapsed because it was basically a house of cards. Which begs the question, of course, as to why that process took place in the first place, which is probably what I was anticipating you going on to.
That's a good point. I mean, the
this crisis, does it mean?
The current one, yes. So, he's talking about.
But it has finished, the crisis. It was just 5% negative growth, and it has finished as far as I know.
Well, certainly in the UK, growth has resumed. But that's it took a lot longer than normal.
He's talking about Greece and Spain.
I think he's talking about the worldwide situation there. Yeah. And there's some bits of the crisis that are still ongoing, and there's some bits that have recovered. You're talking about the collateralized default swaps. And in fact, I mean, they weren't as bad a sounding investment as they've been made out to be. I mean, the point was they were collateralised. At the back end of it, even though they were debt defaulters, was a house. The only way that these could fall was if house prices suddenly started falling. And of course, then you've got to look at why house prices started falling, which is workers' wages must have been falling because...
Well, workers losing their jobs.
Workers because losing their jobs because of...
Because the financial instruments were falling.
Yes, as they absolutely said.
They didn't see a connection. This is interesting. They didn't see a connection between the house of cards they were building up and what was going to happen on the floor, on the ground. For some reason, that disconnect. And I think one of the reasons why that disconnect occurred, at least on a psychological level, was because economics at the time was in the throes of this new theory, a new paradigm. What's it called? Can't remember the full name. A new paradigm theory or
market efficiency sort of stuff.
Yeah, this idea that you could have the boom and bust cycle been broken, and you could just have endless growth. Gordon Brown, of course, famously posited this idea, wasn't it? His idea. Everyone believed it though. And of course, we all knew that was bullshit. And of course, it happened. Boom and bust is back. And I think in terms of what is a crisis, also, I mean, I don't think we can define a crisis in just in terms of how the media or the political class define a crisis, as in using statistics to 3 months of non-growth equals a recession. If it goes on a bit longer, it becomes a crisis. I think we...
Yeah, what is your definition?
My definition would be that there's been a crisis of... Well, some people say that capitalism is crisis. It's always been in a state of crisis from when it was born. There was never a time when it wasn't in a crisis. There was never this time when it sort of emerged in perfect form and it was functioning along quite nicely. Then it sort of went...
Crisis is negative growth. Negative growth has ended. It was about 5% for Britain has ended.
We may
enter into another crisis. This is the problem with the collapse of
the idea of that being a crisis. I'm saying that's a...
It's negative growth. It has ended for Britain.
I think the point is...
The growth is positive.
Negative growth is a crisis for capitalists. So whereas there's a crisis that's been going on for workers and for human beings around the world, I mean, Syria is a crisis, war is a crisis.
We are talking about economic crisis, not about war and things like that. War is different and the party has not taken side ever in the war between different countries. But the problem is we are talking about economic crisis.
But when was there not an economic crisis? That's my question.
Well, if you mean in terms of for the poor and the people who are starving in their millions, certainly that there is an economic crisis, yes, and for the working class.
Even from the point of view of capital, I mean, we've had growth since the 70s, but most economists who know anything would recognise that capitalism was in crisis in the 70s at the same time there was growth occurring. So... The idea, I don't think they can have this sort of linearity of, because we can manufacture statistical growth that means there isn't a crisis. I think there's different levels of economic crisis, and I'm talking about economic crisis, not war or anything else, although that's connected. But economic crisis, I don't go along with this. Oh, the crisis is over because the economy grew at 0.1% last quarter. Not that kind of sort of question time economics that you get on Thursday evenings, ironically.
I mean, certainly, I mean, one thing I was going to come on to is that we are talking here, yes, about people, about a question of playing by the rules. Yeah. So we're not talking about Bernie Madoff-style Ponzi schemes or state intervention and quantitative easing, which are essentially cheating by the market game.
They've always done that, Bill. I mean, there's never been a time they worked when they were not doing it. This is the point, and I think a lot of the new classical economists of the last 30 years or so have always liked to go for this idea there was this utopian time 200 years ago where there was this pure capitalism, then the state got involved for inexplicable reasons and buggered it all up. Then you had things like trade unions.
The problem is that, in fact, in opposition, I have calculated it. The growth has been 2.6%. From 2003 to 2013, growth of real GDP per person, its annual average growth has been 2.6%, more than any time in Britain's history.
What, the world history, the world economy? Since
for Britain. For Britain.
For
Britain. For Britain. For world, negative growth has ended as well. And for Britain, we have had from 2003 to 2013, 2.6%. Well, this is even more than what it has had for any other period, quite a few years period. I have sent the article to account. It has been more than any other period.
So if there wasn't the dip of 2007-2008, it would have been a phenomenal growth in the last 10 years, wouldn't it?
Yes, never in Britain's growth since 1870, from 1870 to 1913.
Well, you know, how they calculate the GDP is a controversial thing. I mean, it's not controversial, but this is most
economists say. We cannot say they don't know anything and deny the truth. The society has gone out of the recession, but if people are, the unemployment is high, is not economic growth. We shouldn't mix economic growth problem with unemployment. Can be high at the top of a boom as well.
I'm not sure that
this is crisis for people, not for the economy.